man with the game information. Game and Steve, Game and Steve. Xbox, Nintendo, PC, or PlayStation. Game and Steve, Game and Steve. Giving the news to the nerd generation. Game and Steve. Give me news,
give me news,
give me views,
give me views.
Game and Steve,
Game and Steve. He got the game.
What's the scene?
What's the scene?
What's the mean?
What's the mean?
Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for the hardest working man in the game industry, the one-man vortex of gaming information, the man who beat Sonic in a foot race, ladies and gentlemen, Gaming Steve!
Hey there, welcome to Gaming Steve, the home of intelligent game discussion. I'm your host, Stephen Glicker, and in this week's show, we go through the latest gaming news. In Spore Talk, I answer your questions about Will Wright's upcoming game, Spore. My preview this week is the eagerly anticipated Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion, where I will go through my experience of playing the game for over 6 hours on both the PC and the Xbox 360. My review this week is Space Rangers 2 for the PC, which actually is almost like Oblivion in space in some ways. It's really an interesting game. My retro review this week is Bungie's classic Pathways into Darkness for the Macintosh computer. That's right, a Macintosh retro review this week. My Name That Game contest, as always. My show mail feature, where I'll be going through and answering your many questions. And then final thoughts. So before I go into the show, just a few housekeeping notes I thought I'd go through. Icon, don't forget I'll be at Icon next month giving some speeches. Some people have asked me if I can tape my speeches and then put them up as separate podcasts. I'm going to check with the guys at Icon to see if that's possible. My speech, I'm giving a speech myself, and Icon, by the way, is a science fiction convention in New York on Long Island, and it's one of the biggest in the East Coast. I think it's actually the biggest in the East Coast, and I'm going to be giving a talk along with a couple of other people in the gaming industry, and I'm going to actually talk about the Game Developers Conference that I'm attending as well. And if anyone's going, let me know. Drop me an email. I'm going to be at the Game Developers Conference all 5 days, which is from March 20th to the 24th. But back to Icon real quick. I'm going to be talking about GDC and what I saw there and answering questions. And then there's panel discussions. And we're still figuring out exactly what panel discussions we're going to talk about. Some of them are going to be like the history of video games. Some are going to be talking about how to design a game. Another panel is going to be talking about a massively multiplayer online role-playing games, things like that. And these panel discussions have like 3 or 4 other people on it. So I have to find out if it's okay to tape these things because it's not just going to be me on these panel discussions. It's going to be me, then other people in the industry. So I'll get back to whether or not that's okay. And also, believe it or not, next week is the one-year anniversary of the launch of Gaming Steve because I actually started this show on Game Developers Conference 2005. That's when I first started the show on the website. And it was very early last year. It was actually the very beginning of March because they didn't have it in their normal location. Usually they have it at the end of March. So I really don't know what we're going to do. We'll do something special. I'm not sure. Maybe give out some prizes or have some contests. I really haven't thought about it too much, but it sort of snuck up on me. But yeah, 1 year going strong, and the show is doing great. It was actually ranked in iTunes, I saw the other day. It was like in the 30s, like 30, I think it was ranked. It was actually even above some of the best podcasts, in my opinion, you know, like GameSpot and PC Gamer. Those I listen to those all the time. I think they're really great podcasts, and I was right up there with them neck and neck. So I really want to thank everyone for listening to the podcast and giving me so much support. With that, let's get into the news.
Gaming news! Gaming news!
So we had a story here which got a lot of press last week. Merrill Lynch guesses at $800 for PlayStation 3 cost. An analyst in Merrill Lynch predicted that the PS3, which has been delayed by over 6 months. Sorry, he said it could be delayed by over 6 months. Also suggested that the PlayStation 3 could cost Sony up to $800. He went through and explained the reasonings because he said, like, the Blu-ray drive is going to cost $350. The cell processor is going to cost $230. The NVIDIA RSX chip is going to cost $70. The memory will be $50. Bluetooth and Wi-Fi chips will bring it up to $800. Here's where it gets kind of interesting. Now, I read these reports all the time. I'm actually very involved in the stock market and have been for well over 20 years now and follow these guys really closely. And I have a lot of friends tied into the industry. I've really been doing it since high school. And these reports, first of all, just to give you an idea, the guy actually – I question this report. The guy actually even did his math wrong. If you do the math, he says it came out to $900, and that's what a lot of people have been reporting, and this just goes to show you how much some news people actually read these reports. That they just see, oh, $900, and that's what they write. They don't actually read them. Well, I went down and I actually read the report. He did his math wrong, and it actually came out to a little under $800. So even though he said $900, he miscalculated. So it's actually $800. So that's the first thing. Take that away from this report, see how accurate it is. The other thing is that this is just this guy's opinion, okay? Yes, he is an analyst and he does work for Merrill Lynch, but that's all it is. And these guys have agendas just like anyone else, and don't think otherwise, because these guys make a lot of money buying and selling stocks. And unlike you and me, like if I went out there and I said, oh, you know, I think the PlayStation 3 is going to stink, well, no one's going to really care probably too much. But if one of these analysts goes out there and says, I think the PlayStation 3 is going to stink, sure enough, they can drive down the price of Sony by 5, 10, 15% just by saying that. And maybe it's temporary, but their words have a lot of weight. And who knows what, you know, their actions are. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. A few years ago, it was either two or three Christmases ago, I think it was two, where the, you know, video game sales were doing really, really great. And this one analyst on this Monday morning, right like the week before Christmas, put out a report where he said that he, quote, walked through four stores in Midtown Manhattan and didn't like what he saw. And he predicts that video game sales were going to be off this year because of that. Because of that's all he did. So this guy walked through four stores in Manhattan. Okay, it's not like this guy did polls or anything. He just decided to get up one morning, walk through some stores. He didn't like what he saw, and he said, you know what? I think video game sales are not going to be that good this year. And that day, all the video game companies were down like 5%, which is a lot for a stock. And they were just being hammered for the rest of Christmas because of what this guy said. And was he right? No, he was horribly wrong. Video game sales were once again, it was another record year, and video game sales were up, and everyone did great. And that was one of the better years for the video game industry, I remember. And this one guy, I mean, that's, you know, it's like he bases an entire opinion on this. So this sort of stuff, you know, when you read these reports, don't think that these guys don't have their own agendas, that they don't have their own, you know, things going on within the company or what, you know, they're trying to support. Maybe Merrill Lynch is really trying to support Microsoft or someone else, and they're doing this. Who knows? So, I'm not saying that they're doing this to specifically hurt Sony, but lo and behold, surprise, surprise, the stock went down, and there's been all these reports and now speculation. But these guys, really, the difference between them and you and me is that they have a job where they say this, and that's about it. So, I really don't read too much into these reports, because this isn't research. This is a guy's opinion, and he just works for Merrill Lynch. And, yeah, he gets paid probably a mint for having his opinion, but you know what? Okay, even if it does cost $800, Sony is not going to be stupid enough to release a PlayStation 3 for $800-$900. Unless this thing, I don't know, cures cancer, I really don't think people are going to go out and spend that much money for this sort of system. It's going to have to be absolutely phenomenal. You know, expect it to probably be around $399, maybe, and that's maybe $499. I can't imagine they're going to even go up that high. But you know what? They'll take a loss because that's just such a huge amount of money. They would never do it. Never. But just don't believe what you read all the time. EA slashes new game prices by 20%. They have announced that Fight Night Round 3 is going to sell for $39.95, which is usually it's about $10 less than what normal prices are. They're only about $50, and Black and as well as The Godfather are also going to sell for $39.95. That's only for the Xbox and the PlayStation 2. That's not for the Xbox 360. For the 360, the prices are still going to be $60. Now this is another odd thing. It's like, okay, so these games that are going to come out, and this is great. I mean, this is actually not unexpected because you know, right now, this is the best time to sell games for the PlayStation 2 and the Xbox. This is considered the cream of the crop. This is the best time because there's more PlayStations 2 now in stores in homes than at any other time. And, you know, even if they get a small percentage of that, that's still a massive amount of sales. And it's still right before the next gen. People are still wanting to play their the PlayStation 2. The Xbox is actually, you know, it's still pretty good for the Xbox as well, but, you know, obviously people are waiting for the Xbox 360. But here's an interesting item, is The Godfather. Okay, we'll take that as an example. That game comes out for, let's say, the PlayStation 2 and the Xbox 360. If it's only going to be $40 for the Xbox version and $60 for the 360 version, what additional items are they going to put in to incentivize me to actually buy it at that higher price? A perfect example is the game Gun. Now, the game Gun costs $60 if you buy it for the 360, and it's like $50-$40. I've seen it even lower now. It's been going on sale for the other systems. Now, it's still not on sale for the 360, and from what I see, the game is exactly the same. There's no reason to buy the 360 version except for the achievements, and that's it. The resolution, in fact, ironically, actually looks worse for Gun in the 360 because it literally wasn't made as to really take advantage of the 360 hardware and graphics, so it actually doesn't look as good. So my big thing is that, look, if you guys are going to do this, that's great, but I don't see, you know, here's another reason. It's like, you know, unless these games are really going to be phenomenal for the 360 and they're really going to add a lot to them, I'm not even going to bother, you know, buying them for the 360. I'm just going to get the regular Xbox version or even the PlayStation 2 version because it's not worth the extra $20. The achievements, woohoo, you know what? I'm not going to pay $20 just to get some achievements. They better have some extra bells and whistles in there for me to fork over the extra money. But good thing, yay, EA for cutting prices. Good idea. More shenanigans. Infinium opens their books, and it looks like they are very, very cash-strapped. Okay, let's go through this. Now, Infinium, they're the guys that made the Phantom console, you know, that vaporware that never really came out. It never came out. It doesn't exist. But let's go through. They actually opened up their books, and everyone is able to see exactly what they've been spending their money on. So, from inception in December of 2002 through September of 2005, they racked up $62.7 million in losses. So we'll say $63 million they've lost so far. Now, of that money, now here's where it gets crazy. $3.5 million was spent on development costs. So where did the rest of the money go? Towards consultants, $12.8 million to consultants, salaries, $11.9 million in salaries, and then general administrative expenses, which is $5.9 million. So roughly of the $63 million, almost $59 million went towards people. And a small percentage of that went to actually creating the console itself. Now, again, I've been following the stock market and been doing this for quite some time. Now, these type of scams, and that's what I'm going to call this, these type of scams come up all the time in every industry. And let me tell you how to do it. Let me tell you how to start your own company and make millions off unsuspecting people, okay? Now, I'm condoning this. I think these people are the lowest scum on the planet Earth, and they belong in, oh, I don't know, the ninth level of hell. I mean, these are really the nastiest people. So what they do is that they will find something that's very hot and in the news right now. Like, you know, maybe it's biotech, maybe it's video games, you know, maybe it's whatever new technology is sort of on the news. And they'll go around and they'll say, okay, we're going to do something really amazing. You know, for video games, we'll take video games as an example. It's very easy to say, okay, we're going to come out with a new console. We're going to come out with a new system. Now, it's not enough just to come out with a new game because a new game doesn't require that much money. So you really want to do something extravagant that has potential. So you say you're going to come out with a new console, or you're going to come out with a new technology that will revolutionize this industry, something like that. So you come up with some really highfalutin idea that requires, say, you know, $50 million or so to create. You then get like one or two people in the industry that are somewhat leaders, whether they, you know, worked for another company in the industry or, you know, they have some connections. But you try to get someone who actually has some connections to the industry. And then you go around and you meet with potential investors. Now, you're thinking to yourself, Well, this is so stupid. Who on earth would invest $5, $10, $15, $20, $30 million in one of these ideas? Don't they see it's a scam? Well, believe it or not, this sounds beyond crazy, but some of these people don't seem to mind or care. And in fact, some of these people actually have to write off their money, okay? This happened to a friend of mine who said his company was actually bought out by another company just to lose money. So they actually took his company, ran it into ground so that they didn't have to pay as much in taxes. Okay, now this is getting a little confusing, but long story short, this is that some people invest this money because you know what? They have so much money, and maybe they have $1 billion, or say they have a fund of maybe $200 million to work with. And that's the thing. Some of these investors, it's not their money. What they'll do is they'll get money from tons of other investors. They'll make it and put it into a large pool, and then they'll dish it out. And they'll place bets. So maybe they have $200 million to invest that year. So maybe they'll put $5 million $10 million in like 20 to 40 companies. And they know most of those, if not, you know, just about all of them are not going to work out. As long as one of them turns into a Google, so be it. So you know what? They, you know, they're very busy. They're trying to make these deals, and it looks sexy. They're like, you know what? Hey, here we go. We got a video game company. It looks pretty cool. They'll be able to put it on their, you know, they'll put it on their spec sheet. They'll show people, hey, look, you know, this is what we're investing in, and that's how they do it. It's scary how easy it is to sometimes get this sort of money. So they go out, they get this money, then they, you know, they have this round of investing. And then what do they do with the money? They spend it. I mean, they take it. I mean, it's crazy, you know. That's why all of a sudden you see, I mean, it's hard. They can't just write themselves checks for $1 million or to give themselves these crazy salaries of $2-3 million each. They can't do that. But they can very easily give themselves, oh, I don't know, a salary of $200,000 or $300,000, you know. And then they go also have company expenses and buy a company car and have a per diem for their house, things like that. And then maybe they're going to hire their wife as a, quote, consultant and pay her $200,000, and then hire their cousin as a, quote, consultant and hire them, pay them $150,000. So, you know, they're just bilking they bilk the company out of all this money. And then, yeah, of course, they go on the side and they actually try to build the system, and they spend, according to this, you know, was it 4% or something of their actual money on actually building a system. And then they advertise it like crazy to make it seem like they're actually doing something. And then they just keep doing this. And, you know, they keep doing it until the well runs dry. And then when it does, so be it. You know, they liquidate the company. They don't lose out. You know, the people in the company made millions of dollars. The investors are out of money, but it's a tax write-off for them, so it's not all that bad, because otherwise they'd have to spend that money and give it to the government or do something else with it. So there you go. And that's how this is done. And this happens every day. And this happens in every industry. We're just starting to see it happen in the video game industry more and more often. And what I actually thought was the most interesting aspect of this is that they, because Infinium, what they did have is they had a lot of people on board on this. And they kept saying, we have all these companies on board. And I was wondering how they even did that. Well, this is how they did it, is that they actually, for their Phantom Game Service, they actually were going to pay these publishers money to be part of their service. They had advanced royalty sales. They were going to give $500,000 to Atari, $225,000 to River Deep, $125,000 to Eidos, $25,000 to Codemasters, and $10,000 to Enlight. And there was this and a few other companies. So what they said to them is, you say you're going to publish for us. Say, go to Atari. Say, you say you're going to publish on our system, and we're going to give you an advance royalties $500,000. How's that sound? And I guess Atari said, you know what? That sounds pretty good. You know, what are we just giving you our name, and we get $500,000? Okay. So then they do it, and then they say, look, Atari's publishing with us. Now Eidos is publishing with us. And by the way, did any of those people get paid? Of course not. What are you, crazy? You think they're going to actually pay that money? No, no, no. You silly people. No. What they do is they say they're going to pay you the money, and then they use it to bilk everyone else, okay? Now, this might sound really like I'm, you know, going crazy here, or like this stuff doesn't really happen. This stuff happens all the time. This actually, I can't even get into it, but this actually happened to a friend of mine who was trying to, is this person in Florida was trying to bilk him. And it's a very long story, but he fought him in court. He actually won and did fine. But it's, this stuff happens so much and in every industry. And it really, it's unbelievably easy how to do this. Okay. It's scary. And this isn't going to be the end of it. And as I said, right now, video games are hot. So you're seeing this in the video game industry, but the Phantom console and remember the Gizmondo, and you'll see this is not going to end anytime soon. Speaking of the Gizmondo, the ex-executive actually crashed a car, not just any car. He actually crashed a red 2003 Ferrari that was valued at approximately $1 million on the Pacific Coast Highway, Malibu, California, where it was approximated that he was doing 100 to 120 miles per hour. These cars, by the way, less than 400 of them were made. Let's see, two are actually owned by Nicolas Cage and by singer Britney Spears. Just show you how nice these cars are. So he totally crashed this car. This guy is named Stefan Erickson, and he was the Gizmondo executive who left the company after it was discovered. He may have had ties with the Swedish mafia, but what I love about the story is I'm just going to read right from the actual press releases. When the police arrived on the scene, they found Erickson bleeding from the mouth. Erickson told officials that he was not driving the vehicle, and the man behind the wheel, who Erickson knew only as a German man named Dietrich, had fled the scene. Erickson reported had a blood alcohol content of 0.9, just over the legal limit of 0.8. Both airbags were deployed in the Ferrari, but blood was only found on the driver's side airbag, leading officials to question the existence of this mysterious German. Some reports indicate that police may use DNA testing to determine if the blood is indeed Erickson's. Maybe the, quote, driver had a friend who picked him up. Maybe he thumbed a ride, Sheriff's Sergeant Philip Brooks told local reporters. Maybe he was just a ghost. That's my favorite line in that whole thing. So, yeah, this guy, Erickson, would you have some mysterious German who you just met drive your million-dollar Ferrari at 100 miles per hour? Yeah, I wonder. You know, forensics, I mean, I'm sure most of you guys watch CSI, and these airbags deploy, it's very easy to determine if there was one, if there was two passengers, because when the airbags deploy, they spray this really nasty mist all over the place, and if you're sitting there, it won't hit the seat, so you can see, oh, if it's all over the seat, then obviously someone is sitting there or not, and then second of all, you know, if there's blood on one side of the airbag, you know, it's probably this guy who was driving it, allegedly, but the thing is, everyone's going on, oh, it's a million-dollar Ferrari, million-dollar Ferrari. I'm sure this guy had insurance. I'm sure it's probably covered. Although, if he was drinking and driving, you know, if anything, the police might not do a report, but the insurance company sure as heck will. I'll tell you that much, because they're not gonna pay $1 million just for the heck of it, all right? In other news, Condemned is coming out on April 11th, 2006, for the PC. Condemned, that was my favorite Xbox 360 game made by Monolith, the guys who made Fear, No One Lives Forever, AVP2, all those amazing games. Coming out for the PC, I'm really excited. For those of you who haven't played the Xbox 360 version, and that's such a good version, I can only imagine how much better this game is going to play on the PC because of the mouse and keyboard. In fact, I love this game so much, I might even go through it again on the PC. This really was a great game. So look for that April 11th. Hopefully it's a really good port, and they add some new special features for the PC version. What else? Just a few more quick stories. Sierra Entertainment, which is now a subsidiary of Vivendi Games, is they're releasing some of their classic games for Windows XP, their compilation packs, and they're going to cost about $20 each. They're going to have compilation packs, one for the King's Quest series, one for the Space Quest series, one for the Police Quest series, and then one for Leisure Loot Larry series. And these will all run in Windows XP, no problem, but they don't know exactly what's going to be in each box version. They don't know which King's Quest games, which Space Quest games, Police Quest, etc. And these games, man, these games are such good games, especially if you love old-time adventure games. I really enjoy these. And in fact, King's Quest, God, that's such a good series. I'm trying to remember which version was it King's Quest. It was either 6 or 7. But here is another. This has actually happened to me many, many times, is where I've actually bought. Okay, I bought King's Quest. I believe it was 7. I think. It came out for the Macintosh. It was Color Mac. And I remember I bought it. I was so excited. I bought it the day it came out. I installed it on my Mac. And I played it, like, nonstop. And then I got to this part where you were, like, fighting, I believe, a Minotaur. And the game, like, crashed. And I had this problem with the game. And then I remember I called up Vivendi. And I actually spoke to Sierra Entertainment. And I actually spoke to them. And I think it was, like, the programmers. And I told them, I'm like, yeah, I'm having this problem with this game where I'm, like, you know, at this Minotaur section. And the game's not working. And I remember the guys on the phone, because the game just came out, they're like, and this is, you know, way before, like, video games were as monstrous as they are now. The guy's like, you're at where? You're at the Minotaur? He's like, that's like 20 hours into the game. It's like, didn't the game just come out yesterday? And I go, yeah, you know, I'm like, yeah, what's the big deal? So what's the problem? And then they're like, if you can hear these guys stunned that I actually got that far in the game. Of course, nowadays, that's commonplace, but back then. And they actually found it, and sure enough, they, like, loaded up, and they're like, and you can actually hear guys in the background, like, saying, oh, crap, saying things like that. Like, it was a bug, and I found the bug in the game, and it was a bad bug, actually. It was like a system crashing bug, but they told me like how to get around it, and luckily I was able to finagle my way around it and actually finish the game. But that was such a good game, and then they released a patch. But that's actually that game, and then Might and Magic, not Heroes, the first Might and Magic, that was another one where I actually called up and found the bug in the game, and that's not the last time that I've done that. I'm trying to remember, but a few other games I called up right as the games were released, and I called them and said, hey, what's going on with this? And you'd hear them go, crap. And finally, the DS Lite, which is coming out this week, March 2nd. Is that this week? Yeah, this week in Japan. Some bad news for those of you who might have pre-ordered it is the Ice Blue and the Naval version colored DSs are not coming out until March 11th. Nintendo apologized. That's what they actually put out. If you see them, they're apologies. They're not press releases, they're apologies. They apologize that this is for this delay, but they didn't feel they can actually get out enough shipments of the DS in time for March 2nd, so they're waiting 1 week to release it. But the white version, the crystal white version, is coming out and will be out for launch. So for those of you, I've gotten some people asking me, you know, should I buy them overseas? Should I buy them, go to one of the, there's like a million stores online that sell them for about, I've seen them for about $160, $170 to ship them over here to the U.S. Should they buy the Japanese version? Should they wait? You know, these things aren't region encoded at all, so there's probably no reason whatsoever why you can't buy the DS Lite from Japan. It'll work fine, and there's going to probably be little to no difference. You know, maybe, obviously, the packaging is going to be different. I don't even think you're ever going to be able to tell the difference between a U.S. version or a Japanese version. They're probably identical. So, and every game is going to work. It's going to be exactly the same. So go ahead, buy the, you know, if you really can't wait, go ahead and buy the Japanese version. I was actually going to buy it, but I'm going to wait a little bit. So what I'm going to do is just wait for the Japanese version to come out, read some reviews, just make sure it's okay, and there's absolutely no issues with it whatsoever, and then I'll probably get my version. So that is the news for this week. Let's get to Sport Talk.
Sport Talk!
So in Sport Talk this week, I'm going to answer one quick question. This is actually an exciting time for Wheelwright Sport because almost a year ago to the day, actually about 51 weeks ago, Wheelwright stunned the world by announcing this game even existed and told everyone about Spore. And this year at GDC, he's giving a keynote, and two of the members from the Spore development team are giving speeches as well. And I'm going to be there, of course, covering it all, talking about it on the show, writing about it, stuff like that. And, of course, if you're interested in Spore, the forums are nuts as usual, the Gaming Steve Spore forums, where they seem to be gearing up almost in anticipation of all the new information that's going to come out from GDC. And even if there's no public information, says I'm going to be at all the talks, trust me, there's going to be new information because I'm going to be talking to the developers myself as well. So we're going to get some new things. But before that, let's get into a question that Darren wrote me. He writes, I'm an amateur 3D modeler who spends a lot of time visiting modeling-related forums, along with cars and sexy ladies, alien creatures, and extremely popular subject matter for many people to model. While many of these are crafted amazingly, most just don't have any magic, or in some way just plain unappealing. As you know, in traditional game development, creature creation is a lengthy process, and even then, the results cannot be so hot. How will the engine allow players to quickly create consistently interesting creatures for me to download? Is there any type of ranking system for player-created content so I could avoid the uninteresting content? Thanks for the great show, Darren. Darren, actually, I have spoken to the woman who's in charge of all of that, and they're still figuring it out, and they I believe we talked about this in my interview with Will Wright, but way back when, it was like show like 14, I think it was, or 15. But how it is, they're working on that right now, but yes, there is going to be a ranking system It's going to work kind of similar to The Sims 2, is that people will be able to create creatures, and there will be some way to actually visibly see the creatures on the website. And then, yeah, there will be, they want to encourage, I know this, you know, they want to encourage the best crafters and the best people who make, you know, the best aliens and the best vehicles and the best houses and things like that to continue to do so. So there will be ranking systems, there will be voting of some sort. So I don't know if there's going to be a filter in the game where you're going to be able to actually put in, say, okay, you only want to have, say, maybe things ranked 1 to 5 in stars, and you only really want to get things that are ranked 4 or higher or 3 or higher, or, you know, or certain aesthetics. But there's going to be some things that are going to be ranked by other people, and there's going to actually be some code in the game that will actually sort all of these. And again, Will Wright sort of talks about this. This is like a monster undertaking. Sort of the way Amazon does this is that if you look at Amazon, you know, if you say, if you like this book, well, if you like this book, then you'll probably also like these books. They're going to do something that's very similar in Spore from what I've heard and what I understand, is that you're going to actually have the ability to, like, if you like certain types of creatures, then, okay, if you like those creatures, then you're probably going to like these creatures as well. And they're going to use relational ranking to figure that out. So that's going to really work very well towards automatically, you know, getting you what you want. It's, you know, because tastes are varied. You know, it's like a creature you might feel visibly unappealing, someone else might really love that. So it's hard to say what's really, quote, the best. But it will be able to say, okay, you know, would you like these creatures? So you should like these creatures. But someone else might hate that, and they might like something else totally different. So it's going to work for everybody. But I know that that is actually a massive undertaking. They've been spending well over a year just developing that system, and they're still working on it. But, you know, and the good thing about something like that is, and this is sort of the same thing with massively multiplayer games, is that because it's an online function, there's an online engine for this, is that they can keep doing it. That's the beautiful part, is that even after the game is released, they can continuously tweak it and improve it and add to it. So, you know, it's gonna be good. I'm not too worried about that. And they might even be talking about this very subject at Game Developers Conference. I think they will. So thanks for your question, Darren. I'm going to answer a few more questions in the next coming weeks. But let's get into what I know a lot of people have been waiting for, is my preview of The Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion.
Game previews!
So welcome to part one of my preview for The Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion for the Xbox 360 and PC. I'm going to do this in several parts over the next week or two, because to be honest, this thing could be hours and hours long. Because I played this game for over six and a half hours, and I actually went through, I have like 20 pages of notes here. If I read this all and did this all, this podcast could be 4 or 5 hours long. This could be a very long podcast. So you know what? Instead of me trying to do one crazy long podcast, I'm just going to split it up, and you guys can have something to look forward to every single week. You'll have a little bit more. And also over time, if you guys have some specific questions about what I did and what I saw, feel free. This will probably be 2 parts, maybe 3. I'll try to do it in 2 parts. But with that being said, I'm just going to go through my day and tell you what I did and how I played the game and what I saw and experienced and et cetera, et cetera. So with that, I got there nice and early Monday morning last week. I met with Pete Hines, who most of you heard my interview last week, and he showed me around. They had 5 Xbox 360s and no PCs whatsoever. I actually did play the game on both, but what happened is the PCs were delayed in shipping somewhere, and they showed up about an hour later. But I did actually then jump right onto the Xbox 360 and give it a whirl. The first thing I have to say is that I did play this game, Oblivion, back in November when the Microsoft came here. And the difference between it then and now, it's pretty much the same game. I didn't see any difference, but I only played through the intro in November. So, and I played through the intro here a couple of times, so I didn't see any difference whatsoever in the game. With that being said, I will tell you, I started the game up on the 360, and right away, this is one of the best intro sequences, and the first hour of play was one of the best I've ever had for any game, hands down. I have to say, one of the issues with a lot of these the Elder Scrolls games, is that they're difficult for some people to get into. You know, these games really are designed for anyone to play and to do anything you want. They're almost like, I'd say, The Sims in some ways, or even like Grand Theft Auto, or even more like, I'm trying to think, like Star Control in a weird way. It's like these are the ultimate sandbox game. You know, there's quests in this game and main quests, but you can play this game and never, ever, ever do the main quest if you don't want to. You can play this game and just go around and become the best thief in the world or become the best magic user in the world, and that's it. But, you know, when you have that much freedom, it's very tricky. It's like, well, how do you then start the person off? How do you show them they have all this freedom without actually making them feel like they're confined? Well, they finally figured it out. I have to say, after doing this for, last 10 years or so, I feel like they've never quite gotten this right. This time, they were spending the time and effort on getting this just right. I played through the intro three times. I played through it twice in the Xbox 360 and once on the PC. And I have to say, this is one of the best intros I've seen for any game, not just Elder Scrolls. It's beautifully designed, really good dungeon design, and it explains everything you need to know about the game in just such a beautifully well-articulated way, and it's great. It's seamless, too. Before you know it, with an hour in a game, you know how to do everything, and it seems like it was no problem whatsoever to learn it. And then from there, by the time you're actually out in the world, which takes about 45 minutes to an hour, and then the, quote, real game starts where you can go and do everything, you've learned everything. You learned how to use your magic. You learned how to pick locks, how to fight, how to do sneak attacks, whatever you want. So you want to start off in the main quest? You can start off in the main quest. If you want to go into that dungeon over there that you see over the hill, those ruins, you can go over there and you won't die because you know what? You know how to fight, you know how to use magic, you know how to equip yourself. If you want to go and just walk around and pick some berries and use the mortar and pestle and make some poisons and some potions, you could do that too because you know how. And I really have to say that's a testament to how well designed this game is. And I have to say something else is I'm getting withdrawal symptoms. I have to say, even just talking about this game, I can't think of too many games this happened to me. And there's so few games. So I played this game, and I had like this itch to actually go back. I'm like waiting, and I have this like itch I can't scratch. It's like, God, I actually read a couple other previews said the same thing. Like they can't wait to play it, and I said the same thing. I'm like, I gotta get this damn game. I can't wait to gotta call Pete to get a damn preview copy here because I really can't wait to play this again because once I got my taste, I wanted to go back. But with that being said, I'm going to go through the intro in this segment, and then next segment, next week, I'm going to go through sort of the main aspects, but sort of what I did once I got out in the world. I'll tell you about how I stole a horse and how I got into the different guilds and a couple of quests I was on and some of the monsters I was fighting and talking to people and just, as I said, I did this at 6 hours worth of stuff. A lot of things were going on. But that being said, the game starts off where you are actually in a dungeon cell, big surprise, and you really have no idea who you are. Before I get into that, there's an actual intro animation where Patrick Stewart talks to you, and this thing is beautiful, really well done, very powerful, felt like a movie. Drew me right into the game. It wasn't hokey or cheesy at all. Felt just like an action fantasy movie. And from there, you can go in. You're able to design your character. You design their face. A lot of other people have gone over this. You can design their face. You can select their race. You can select their sex. And you can select just about anything you imagine on their facial features. People are saying, oh, you can use this for an hour. You know what this feels like? If you've played City of Heroes, it's pretty much exactly the same. It's that you can change the size of the forehead, size of the cheekbones, size of the eye sockets, etc., etc. So size of the nose, whatever you want could be morphed. I'll be honest, I've done it before, and also you don't really see yourself that much. The game is played in first person. You can't switch to third person. Since you never even see what your face looks like, I didn't really care. So I quickly chose, I believe, an Imperial, which is sort of like the humans, male. Quickly randomized a few faces, got one I liked, named him Stone, and off I was. So I was in the dungeon. You're there. Guy's talking to you for a little bit. Another thing you find out that's really nice is the voiceovers. Really well done. Everything in this game has voiceovers. There's no written text, as far as I know, except for the books. So everything is spoken in this game. Within a minute, Patrick Stewart shows up as the king. with some guards. It turns out that your cell, and I'm not going to give away any spoilers here. I'm going to only give you guys sort of the main gist, and this is stuff you can find any other preview website. And this, again, this is the tutorial, so it's going to be hard for me to tell you how to use the game without about the game without giving it away a little bit. But the king shows up, and he tells you, you know, that basically this is a secret entrance to an underground catacombs, and the king is off somewhere on a mysterious quest, and you have no idea what's going on. You're just a prisoner that's mysteriously there. So the guards tell you that it's your lucky day, but stay out of their way, and you can follow the guards after they open up the secret passage, and they go in. There's some nice chains dangling from the ceiling, so if you want to see the realistic physics, you can just bump into the chains and sort of swing your arm around and hit them and see what happens. And then from there, you're into the catacombs. And right away, you'll actually learn the basics of the game. And the basics of the game, and I'm going to go through all these, you learn how to fight, you learn how to cast magic, pick locks, sneak attack, manage your inventory, repair your equipment, earn skills, and you use a mortar and pestle. So with that being said, right away you find in the very first section there's sort of a dead body there, the skull, some weapons, armor, stuff like that. You can pick up your armor, you can pick up the weapon, you can pick up the torches, you pick up some lockpicks, and something else is you can pick up the skull and crossbones. You can pick up anything you want. In fact, I picked it all up, and then afterwards I turned to Pete, and I'm saying, okay, so what do I do with, like, you know, the skull? Am I ever going to use it? And he's like, nope. You know, you just, it's whatever you, it's like, you know, there's thousands of items in this game that have no purpose other than, you know, decoration. And if you want to pick up, you know, a skeleton, go right ahead. But otherwise, it doesn't really serve any purpose. Maybe you'd be able to sell it for a small amount, but that's it. So I was like, wow. And it was taking up a lot of weight. So I decided to drop the skeleton after I picked it up. I then equipped very quickly a sword in one hand and a torch in another. I actually put, I originally had a two-handed weapon, but one of the things that Pete said and talked to me about was that if you have a two-handed weapon, is that you carry around the weapon with you at all times, and you can't carry a torch at the same time. And it's really annoying because at least the Xbox version I was playing was very, very dark, and it was hard to see, so you really didn't need the torch. So instead, I put on, let's see, I put some arrows in my quiver, so that gets put on your back. I had a one-handed sword, and I also had a torch in the other hand, and a shield. And when you go into combat, you'll automatically put away the torch and have your shield come back out. So within the first few minutes, I found some giant rats. They looked really great, actually. They kind of look like those rats. What was it? The rodents of unusual size from The Princess Bride. They kind of look like that. And they're attacking me, doing some pretty good damage on me as well. But I was able to fight them off, and I'll tell you with that how the combat works. Combat, very basic. It's hack and slash. You don't really have a lot of options. You can attack, you can block, and you can jump around. That's sort of it. But it works well. It's very similar if you played Condemned for the Xbox 360. It actually works almost identical in many ways to that game. That actually each weapon has a different weight and swing type to it. So if you have a really heavy axe, that axe is actually going to weigh and take a lot more to actually swing, even though it does more damage than, say, a dagger or a short sword. Those are going to go much, much quicker. So I found some rats, killed them, and then right away you could, after you kill them, you could take the rat meat off of them. And the rat meat, again, really doesn't serve any purpose, but you can eat it if you really want, and you can use it for the mortar and pestle if you want, which I'll explain a little later. So throughout the dungeon, or should I say catacombs, I'm going through the catacombs, killing some rats, I'm learning how to do this stuff, and then eventually you'll come across a couple of lockboxes. And the lockboxes, that's where you then learn how to pick locks. How picking locks in this game, it's really nice, it's really well done, and what happens is that you have these lockpicks, and you'll pick up them throughout the game. And I was wondering, I was like, well, how come I have like 30 lockpicks? Well, you're going to break them all the time. What happens is that when you find a locked box, the screen will change to tumblers, a cross section of these tumblers. And what happens is that you have to actually push the tumblers into place. And there's 1 to 5 tumblers, so you have to push into place. Once you push all the tumblers into place, you press a button and it tries to turn and open up the lock. And that's how it works. Very easy locks of 1 tumbler you have to push into place. easy locks, maybe two, medium locks, three, hard locks, four, very hard, five. And something else is if your skill isn't high enough, and I'll talk about that in a little while, how skill works, is that you can't even do some of the harder locks. So if your skill is really like novice level and you're trying to do a very hard lock where there's five tumblers in place, the second you push them up, they come right back down. So there's no way in hell you'll ever be able to get the hard lock opened. Luckily, these are very easy locks, and there was only one tumbler you had to push into place. But the timing is actually a little tricky. It looks real simple, but I broke a lot of my locks, no problem, because you push it up, and the second after you push it up, you do have to press the button to try and open it. And if you do it right, your lock pick will break. The good news is that there is an auto lock pick button, auto pick, and you press the auto pick button, and it just tries it for you. You know, if you aren't so good with the timing or you find it too difficult. And that's a real nice option because it still uses, then it just uses your base skill set. And I will say the auto pick really worked well. I think when I was using the easy, I was using the auto pick a lot. And I think it broke once, one time out of like 20 boxes. But anyhow, that's how picking locks works. It's a nice system, not too hard, not too easy, just right. From there, I was exploring the dungeon a little bit more, came up a few more rats, killing them off, and then I came across my magic. And when you learn some magic spells you can learn, two of the spells I learned right away is there was an instant heal, or it's a healing spell, where it would heal you a small amount, and the fireball spell. And with that, actually, let me get into the three main attributes, is you have health, mana, and endurance. And this is always represented on the screen. The health is, well, it's your health. Mana is, well, it's how well you cast spells. And endurance is like how much you can jump around, how much you can carry. Running will take up endurance, things like that. So your endurance will recharge. Actually, your endurance recharges pretty quickly. And your mana a little bit slower. And your health, you actually have to eat items or rest or cast spells on yourself. But one of the big advantages of this game, of the Oblivion over the past games, is the seamless integration of magic and combat. And not only, it was beautiful, beautiful thing to behold. It was really well done. For instance, one thing I did is I had a fireball spell. And what I would like to do is when I saw creatures far away, or especially if they didn't notice me, is I would cast a fireball on them, get their attention, they would charge me. So what I would do is that if you have a fireball spell, and you say you also have a shield and a dagger in your hands, you will very quickly, you say you cast a fireball spell, your dagger will right away go, you'll sheathe your dagger, your hand will go up, you actually see your arm like in front of your face or on the side, and magic will appear around your arm, you point out your arm, fireball will come out, you quickly drop down and get your dagger again. And again, really nice, smooth. It also opens you up to attack. So if you're going to use magic, you really have to defend yourself or sort of back off because you don't have any weapons in your hand whatsoever and your shield really can't be used. So it gives you a few seconds of vulnerability. And at the same time, it's just a beautiful effect. And I was really having a great time casting fireballs on these creatures. They burst into flames. They run around screaming. It's really, really well done. One thing I will say, and here's one of my first criticisms, or at least concerns, is the Xbox controls versus the PC controls, since it does have sort of first-person shooter feel to it, it was much more difficult to use the Xbox 360 controller than the PC, and that's just the nature of the game, because, you know, I don't know if there was an auto-lock feature, or maybe it wasn't turned on, but it was tricky, because what happens is, if you have creatures that are moving, especially flying imps, and you're trying to cast a fireball spell, because when you press the button, the fireball spell's not instant. It's not like an attack. You have to put away your weapon, you have to cast the magic, and then throw the fireball spell. You press the button, you might have to wait 2 or 3 seconds, then the fireball goes off. So you really have to time it perfectly and sort of keep the creature in sights. But the nature of an Xbox controller without, you know, especially a first-person shooter, and especially if something's halfway across the room, it's tough. It's really hard to keep them locked on. With the PC, I actually much preferred the PC controller in general. Just being able to, you know, lock onto a target with the mouse and keyboard was a heck of a lot easier. So that being said, I do believe, I'm not sure 100%, I've been reading on and off, yes, no, I should really ask Pete this, if you can put a mouse and keyboard on your 360 and then play the game using that. I've heard some people say yes, some people say no, but I will have to say the mouse keyboard was definitely superior if you're planning on using a lot of magic or you're planning on using bow and arrow or any ranged weapons, because it really was just much easier to hit creatures using the mouse. But again, it wasn't a deal breaker, trust me. The game is still very playable. And very often these creatures will charge you right away. So when they're really close to you, getting a fireball and hitting some creature isn't too difficult. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. But as I said, magic, really, really well done. And I had so many magic spells, I won't even get into them. I had tons of magic spells. It was crazy by the time I got out of the catacombs. So those are the ones I used the most. One thing to be said is that you can auto-map anything onto your control pad. Actually, how it works is you go into your inventory, and actually I'll explain that right now, how it works, is that when you go into your inventory, you can select any item, and then you can press your keypad, either 1 through 8 on your keyboard if you're playing the PC, or the direction pad on the Xbox 360 controller, and assign anything you want. You can assign spells, you can assign weapons, so if you want to quickly change your weapons, you name it, you can assign it. Anything that's selectable in your inventory, you can select as a quick select. It does stink there's only 8. You can't really go above that, which kind of makes sense, but because right away I very quickly filled up my first 4 with my weapons, 2 weapon sets, and a fireball and heal spell. So right away I was using that. Again, there's an advantage for the Xbox using a control pad. Heck of a lot easier to quickly go back and forth between 8 different control types than going through 1 through 8 on the keyboard, I'll tell you that much. So there's where the Xbox controller came in a lot more handy. So with that being said, I'll get into the inventory. How you manage your inventory in the game is that you select in the lower left-hand corner, there's a compass, and you select it, and then voila, your inventory will come up. Again, this is one of the best aspects of the Oblivion, is the inventory control. And this will make or break the game. And not just this game, but any of these type of games. And I'll tell you why. It's because if it's difficult to manage your inventory, especially on a 360 or any console, I mean, you're just not going to get into the game because you're going to be fighting the control scheme. But this isn't just well done. It's beautifully done. And I mean beautifully as in graphics are amazing. It's really nice. Everything has an icon to it. It looks like an old parchment, so everything's written out. All the maps look like they're hand-drawn. All your quests look like they're from some ancient text from like the medieval Europe. Really, really well done. You know, it's the little features like that. It just envelop you into the world. With that being said, how the inventory works is that there's a main tab on the bottom that will let you either select your inventory, your spells, your skills, your maps, or your quests, and then there's sub-tabs. So, for instance, if you're in your inventory and you select your inventory tab, it'll then go up to the sub-tabs where you can select just your weapons or just your armor or just your, you know, miscellaneous items, etc. There's also a main tab which will have everything listed. So you can go to the main tab and where everything and all everything's grouped together, or if you just want to go to your inventory of your weapons, no problem, you can go there. So again, very easy to find what you're looking for. You can also sort the columns. It's one of those things like sorting columns. Why didn't anyone else think of this? Yes, you can sort the columns. So if you want to quickly find in your entire inventory what's the heaviest items, because if you're encumbered and you can't walk around, you can then drop your heaviest items very, very easily. Again, really well done. Spell management works exactly the same as the inventory management. It breaks up your spells in different categories. Skill management, well, skills, you just sort of list out your skills. There's not too much management there. Maps, list out all the maps. Auto mapping's done really well. Nice thing about auto mapping, too, is it'll actually write out the names of everything you see and do. And then the quests, really well done. Reminds me of Baldur's Gate 2. It shows you the quests you've completed, shows you upcoming quests, lists out everything you need to know. You don't have to keep a notebook anymore when you're playing the game. You know, I never had a problem of knowing exactly what I needed to do, and it's great. And then also I'd even say the compass, something else. The compass works almost three-dimensionally, even though it's a two-dimensional compass, by having markers on the compass showing you where towns are. So if there's towns that are nearby, there'll be little markers indicating the towns, and the closer they are, the darker the marker is, so you can even indicate approximately how far they are. And then the main quest is indicated by this arrow, so you always know exactly where to go. So if you don't even want to ever open up the map and just, you know, see where you need to go, you can just open up, you know, you can just look at your compass and say, okay, that's where I need to go, and it's getting dark. So I must be getting closer, and voila. Anyhow, back to the catacombs. As I was going through the catacombs, I stumbled upon my very first goblin. And here's where, like, little things like design really come in play. You know, it wasn't some goblin. It was just in the catacombs and doing whatever. No, this was a goblin. He had a little camp going on, and he was actually had a giant rat on a spit, and he was cooking him over a fire for, like, dinner. You know, again, really beautiful little things like that that really bring this game to life. So you are then taught how to sneak. The game teaches you if you want to sneak. And how sneaking works is that you actually press down on the control pad and you will then crouch down and the cursor, the icon, will change to an eye. And the eye, depending upon what color it is, will show you whether or not you're hidden in shadows or not. And the better you're hidden in shadows, the easier to sneak up on your targets. When you're sneaking, you can either do sneak damage, you know, you can sneak up to someone and do a lot of damage on them, or you can try to pick their pockets. Since I didn't really want to pick the goblin's pocket, I just snuck up and quickly killed them. And actually, just had a funny, just had a coincidence or whatever, when I killed him, he actually fell on the spick, and he got to see the real world physics in action. As he fell on the spick, he like arched his back over the dead rat, and his legs like flopped over onto the ground. And again, little things like that, lots of fun. So he actually, from there, has a little table, and you can pick up some poisons there. Definitely don't drink it, but you can put up your poison on your blade. That will do a lot more damage. It's a one-time deal, though, so when you put your poison on the blade, it only works once, and then you have to do it each time. You have to reapply your poison. But for really tough creatures, it's something good to do. There was some fruits and vegetables, and I believe that's where I also got the mortar and pestle. And the mortar and pestle works very similar to, say, if you play Dragon Quest VIII, there's this alchemy pot in Dragon Quest VIII. You just drop two to four items in it, and then something is created. Unlike other games, like Dragon Quest VIII, the way it worked, so you had no idea what to put in there, and you put something in, and then it created something. Well, in this game, in Oblivion, it's much better. It actually will tell you which items you can put in there and then what it will create. And even when you're looting corpses, it'll tell you, for instance, the rat meat can be used in the actual mortar and pestle and create something. And so you can put one item and two items in there. Eventually you find fruits and vegetables. You can put some of those in there. I was able to create some poisons. I tried those out. Eventually you can create some health potions. And there's berries you can pick in the world, fruits. There's a lot of things you can find, not just on dead creatures and killing them and getting their meat and using that in mortar pestle, but just things floating around the real world. So already, as you can see, and this is just the intro, just to give you an idea how deep and how involved this game is. From there, I actually was able to see a little bit more of the real world physics and Radiant AI. There's a section where I came upon, there was an actual trap where there was a goblin hanging out, and there was these three very large looking nasty weights on top of the ceiling, and you could, if you're not careful, you can set off the weights and you'll get killed very quickly, or you could have more fun and do what I was doing, is wait till the goblin's walking around, he's walking near the weights, you then shoot your fireball off near the trap, set it off, and have the weights kill your goblin for you. And it's one of those wonderful, it's like one of those wonderful things that happens in those games where you're like, wow, the weights came down and smashed them halfway across the hall, and it was really cool, and you can never recreate the same experience twice. It's a beautiful thing about when you have a real-world physics system in these type of games, is that you're always finding these guys die in these weird kind of funny ways. But with that being said, I continued along the game. Let's see, what have I covered? Yeah, I've covered pretty much everything. Skills, repairing your equipment, and that's it. So I'll get to that in a second. So what happened is next is you're walking through. Eventually, not just regular, there's regular goblins. Eventually, I came across goblins that had arrows that were shooting at me. One of the things with the arrow goblins is that it is nice if you shoot back at them with arrows, the arrows do stick into the goblins, and you see them running and chasing after you with arrows being stuck out of them. And then after you kill them, sometimes you can recover your arrows. And then finally, you get to a main large cave. And it's my understanding that most of these little mini dungeons do have a boss creature at the end. And then this boss creature was this female goblin shaman that was firing these like ice blasts at you that really looked, I don't know if they did a ton of damage, but the ice damage looked nasty, let me tell you. And she also kept casting a shield on herself that was absorbing damage. I actually tried out the Radiant AI system quite a bit and killed her a lot of different ways. I kept going back. And I have to say, I was really, really impressed. One time, I just charged her straight out, and she just was devastating me with those ice blasts just attacking me. And eventually, I did charge her, and she would just dodge and duck and try to avoid my swords. Another time, I snuck up behind her and used the poison dagger on her, and that took her down very quick. Another time, I was just trying to attack her by range. And eventually what happens that it was taking so long is that she ended up no longer using her staff. It actually ran out of charges. And she then just cast shield on herself and was sort of just hiding. So it was really interesting to see how the Radiant AI would react. And eventually you kill her and you get her staff. And again, it's a magical staff. You can recharge it. There's a lot of ways to actually recharge these crystals. But I didn't actually use it too much. I tried it out, but it wasn't doing as much damage as my regular magic. And it's also a two-handed staff. And as I said before, I didn't really like the two-handed weapons as much because then you can't carry a torch. But this is another area where you really see really well-designed dungeon. It was actually a little camp. And then underneath, there's a second level. And then you can see these pens where they're keeping the giant rats where they're going to use them for food for later on in the game. So, or later on in their lives, or whatever. But you know, it's little things like that. It's like it was a thought-out dungeon. You can see that there was goblins down there, that they were living their lives. They weren't just hanging out. That there was traps. That there was, you know, a little camp there. There was like sentries being, you know, all over the place, and they were doing their own little thing. Again, really, whoever designed that dungeon really did a fantastic job. And then you can go down, you can open up the door, you can release the rats if you want, you can kill them, whatever you want. But it's nice to see. It's really fun to go in little pens. After there, you will then get to the catacombs, or the sort of the, you're out of the main catacombs, and you're back in the castle again, and you're sort of in the sewers. You bump into the king again, and he talks to you a little bit. He gives you some, you know, hocus pocus, saying, oh, you know, that I see that you're important, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. And from there, you actually will then get to choose your birth sign and eventually your class. And I'll explain a little bit how that works. So if those of you who played these games before, this hasn't changed too much. Your character's creation is totally up to you, and that's what makes these games so much fun. You don't have to be a fighter. You don't have to be a magic user. You don't have to be a thief. You could be a fighter thief. You could be a magic user fighter. You can be a thief magic user. You could be anything the heck you want, because there's just these systems of skills, and you can choose any skills you want that you're good at. And That's sort of it. There's something else called birth signs. And birth signs, it allows you to be very powerful in one area, but it also makes you not so great in other areas. And there's 13 different birth signs. Some will make you a really strong fighter, but then maybe you're really weak in magic. Others will make you maybe really good at picking locks and really good at thieving skills, but then you won't be good at something else. So, and they're much more powerful than in Morrowind. Morrowind, they had birth signs too. But here, there's like a big cost to some of these benefits. So you really have to carefully choose. And I believe I chose, I think it was like the magician one, where I think I had 100 extra mana points, but I was susceptible to fireball spells or something like that. So I choose my birth sign, and then finally you get to choose your class. And how the class works is that you can select one of the custom-made ones. One of the pre-made ones. There's tons of pre-made classes like Battle Mage and Fighters and etc. There's so many, way too many to even go through. Or you can do a custom class. And that's the beautiful thing. I actually did a custom class. And how it works is that, because I wanted to be a battle mage, I wanted to be, you know, someone who could do magic and fight, wear like plate. So, but I didn't like the pre-made battle mage. So first thing it does is it asks you to select something that you're going to be focused in, either combat magic or stealth as your main focus. I selected magic. Then you have two favorite attributes. There are 7 attributes in the game. There's strength, endurance, agility, speed, intelligence, willpower, personality. And each one of these affects, you know, certain things. Obviously, if you have really good strength, you're going to do a lot more damage. If you have really good agility, you're going to be much better as a thief. If you have really good willpower, intelligence, you're going to be a lot better at magic. So my two favorite attributes, I chose strength because you can never go wrong with strength. And I believe it was either willpower or intelligence, whichever affected mana a little better. So those abilities, you'll always go up in other abilities, but those abilities you'll always be better at. Those will be your favorite abilities. And then finally, you have major skills. Now, in this game, there's 21 skills overall, and this is what really determines your character. Skills are ranked from 1 to 100, and you can get skills in everything. For instance, there's a skill for being acrobatic. There's a skill for lockpicking. There's a skill for different types of weapons. There's light armor, heavy armor, different types of magic groups. You get the idea. So, for instance, if you have a really good lockpicking skill, you'll be really good at picking locks. If you then select it as a major skill, you'll start out, and it's, again, it's ranked from 1 to 100, you start out automatically with a rank of 15 in lockpicking. And then that skill will also go up much quicker than any other skill. And the skills are go up by using them. So the more you pick locks, the faster you're going to get at lockpicking and getting good at lockpicking. Now, imagine you don't pick lockpicking. What does that mean? That just means you will start off as rank 1 in lockpicking, so you don't have a head start. And it takes you a lot longer to actually skill up in lockpicking than anyone else. Good thing is that there's other ways to open up locks. There's spells that open up locks, things like that. But you can choose however you want. If you want it to be a lockpicking, someone who's really good at lockpicking, who's really good at fighting, and really good at magic, yeah, you'll be good at that. And you can choose that. You'll probably stink at everything else. You won't be that great at talking to people, and you won't be that fast and very good at sneak attacks, but you'll be good at those specific skill sets. Personally, what I did is I picked some heavy armor because I wanted to wear plate. I picked some weapon types that I thought that were useful, like swords and one-handed type weapons, and I picked some magics that I liked, and that was it. After that, you name your class. I named my class Stoner, which in retrospect sounds pretty bad. I just named it Stoner because my character was named Stone, not because he's a stoner. Well, anyhow, that being said, you name your class, and voila, you're done. Back to the main story, you then eventually get an amulet from the king. You get your very first main quest where you have to bring it to a contact, this guy, Joffrey, who's the leader of the Blades. And from there, he'll tell you what to do with it because there can't be no king in the kingdom. Bad things are going to happen. Oblivion gates are going to start opening, which I'll talk about next time. And that's how the game really starts getting going. What you can do is, right before you leave, you have to go through the sewers, you kill a few more things, and then right before you leave, it asks you if you want to change your character in any way, shape, or form. You then say, yes, I want to change it. You can redo your entire character from scratch after you've gone through the tutorial, if you don't like what you saw, or if you want, you can just, keep it and say, go right ahead, and then the real game starts. Then you start off, you're off in the main world, you actually see it's absolutely beautiful, it's outside, it's sunny, and even little things like that. It's a sneaky trick, and I've seen other games do this, but Oblivion does it really well. The first part of the game, it's always dark and dank and sort of hard to see, and you're using torches, and then it goes from that to instantly being outside in this radiant sunshine in this hillside with all this green grass and this beautiful lake in front of you, and it's such a contrast, it's actually almost hurts your real life eyes. You're like, whoa, what's going on here? Like, it's like, wow, it's so stunningly beautiful because it's such a contrast from what you just saw. With that, I'm going to actually stop the preview, and next time I'll talk about, let's see, what do I got here? I got so much. I got, let's see, what I did when I stole a horse, when I got to a cave, what I did with some side quests. I had, when I found the Oblivion Gate, let's see, the different guilds, talking to people, the weather effects, quests going and killing wanted people. There's so much. So that's going to be next time because this is already pretty long. But with that being said, I will answer a few questions that people have been asking about the graphics, the capabilities, things like that. I will say, you know what, people are saying, there's like some pop-ups and there's some issues with the graphics. Yeah, you know what? Forget it, okay? You know what? I will tell you, yes, I did see one time when I was in the catacombs, I did see the king was walking around, and he was bald. And then all of a sudden, poof, it popped, his hair popped back onto his head. Did it take me out of the game? Maybe for a split second. That was the only time I saw that. And you know what? It happens, okay? There's a lot going on in the game. There's a lot of memory issues, and it's a very complex, big game. That's also something they probably are working on and doing the final tweaking. Those are the sort of things they do at the very last second. I do know the build I was on was a recent build, but it was a few months old. It was actually the same build from a couple of months ago. So or a couple of weeks ago at least. So that's something that I would not be concerned about. The outside world was stunning, and I tell you, I've never seen bushes so impressed by bushes in my entire life. You know, I was like just walking through the world, going through the shrubbery, thinking, oh my God, this is the best looking shrubbery I've ever seen in a game. It really was absolutely beautiful, breathtaking. The lake, the water looked amazing, ruins, everything. It's just breathtaking. And to see it in motion, the pictures really just don't do it justice. And some people worried that, you know, it might look a little weird because it's so realistic. Maybe it might have that sort of EverQuest 2 vibe to it where things look so real they almost look fake. I'd have to say this game, it looks so real, but because you have different races and because the humans aren't humans, they're Imperials, so they're humanoid, it actually works. Like, they change things just enough in the game, so you're not thinking, oh, that doesn't look like a human. Yeah, it doesn't look like a human because they're not humans. They're Imperials. They're different. Or that doesn't look like a rat person. Well, you know what? Or, like a lizard person or orc. No, you know why? Because they're not World of Warcraft orcs. They're orcs. They're their own orcs. So everything really does look great because you don't have to worry too much. And the things that are, quote, real world, like the beds and the cities and the towns and the stones, those look great because those look exactly like they should look. Even the horses, they look wonderful, fantastic. So the graphics themselves looked amazing. And then finally, and then I'll wrap up the preview, is the difference between the Xbox 360 and the PC version. I will say that the PC version was actually better. It was weird. I played it all day, and I think only one other person played the PC version. Everyone was on the Xbox 360 version, and that's the version everyone wants. And I can see why, because, you know, the Xbox 360 version is going to play exactly the same no matter what, no matter how you play it. It's going to play the same. While the PC version is a little different. But I have to say, I really liked the controls on the PC. I liked having the mouse and keyboard. I just thought the game actually looked better. It just had a little bit more detail to it. And I do think this machines I wore on were pretty crazy, though. If I'm just looking here, yeah, the minimum requirements are 512 megs, a 2 gigahertz Pentium 4 processor. You need a pretty good system and then a fairly decent graphics card. Although they strongly recommend the minimum you have is 3 gigahertz Pentium 4, 1 gigabyte of RAM, and an ATI X800 series card or the NVIDIA 680 series. And it's like, those are the most recent cards. The X800 was, I think, just from last year. That's a pretty recent card. Luckily, I do have all of that and 2 gigs of RAM, but yeah, I will say I'm probably going to get the PC version when it comes out. And not that I don't think, trust me, I think the Xbox 360 version looks amazing and it's beautiful and it's a wonderful version. It's really a question of, you know, it's like almost a PS version versus an Xbox version of the same game. It looks just a little bit better on the PC. I will say there was one really distressing thing on the PC that was driving me crazy. Hopefully they'll be able to fix this, is that the keys, I couldn't change the keys to work with my mouse for the custom keys. So, for instance, if I wanted to move forward, one thing I like to do when I move forward is to make the mouse button 3 my move forward, and you couldn't do that. You can only set it to keyboard commands. So I can change anything on the keyboard, but I can make it mouse button 3. And that actually stunk, actually. I did not like that at all, because I wanted to have the auto walk, just press the mouse button 3 and I can auto walk with just my mouse. So hopefully that will be fixed. Hopefully that's something that will be done in the final version. One thing with the PC is that you do have the development toolkit that you go around and make a whole bunch of fun things in the game yourself. So maybe you can go in and do that yourself and fix it. But that being said, again, oh wow, I've gone a lot into this. That's only the intro. That was just the beginning. Next week, I'll do part 2 of my Oblivion preview, where I'll go into a lot more. So if you have some questions, feel free to ask them. I'm going to do my questions later on the show. Some people actually had some Oblivion questions in the show mail segment, but you can send me an email questions, or you can actually send me voicemail, and I'll answer them on the show, or I'll write you back, either one. And with that, let's get to the next segment, which is my review of Space Rangers 2 for the PC.
Game review! Game review! Game review!
So my review this week is Space Rangers 2 for the PC. And this game is actually not coming out until March 16th, so that's about 2 weeks in the States. But this game has already been out in the UK and Europe for a couple of months now, and I believe it actually came in Russia. It's a Russian game, I think in late 2004, early 2005. So this game's been out and around for quite some time, and I've been hearing amazing things about it. So when I heard it was actually coming out in the States, I got a copy early, and I've been playing it, and I have to say, this game is nuts. This is a great game, but it is crazy. It actually reminds me a little bit of Oblivion in some ways, because you can do anything you want, like a space version. It's also like Star Control 2, in that it has a whole universe for you to explore, and there's different races, different quests you can go on, you can do all this crazy stuff, and even a little bit like Pirates, in that, again, you can do whatever you want. You know, you can go on the major quests if you want to become a pirate yourself, become a pirate. If you actually want to go and earn a living making trade, you can do that. You can run for governments. You can manage colonies. Amazing. The game's crazy, crazy, crazy. So before that, let me get into it. As I said, this game was developed, I believe it was developed by a couple of guys in Russia who just decided, from what I heard on this, is that they just decided to make a game, a turn-based game, and put all the crazy fun things that they like about games into one game and see what the results are. And I have to say, they did a pretty great job. The game is turn-based, but you want to know it because it goes so fast, and the turns are have so much animation in between the turns, is that it feels almost like a real-time strategy game that just pauses a lot. You know, the turns, there are turns, but they just happen so quickly that you wouldn't even know that it's really turn-based. It is in space, and there's a lot of space exploration, trading, quests, combat. There's actually a whole real-time strategy combat aspect to it, which I'll get to in a second. And there's even these text-based adventures that are sort of like choose-your-own-adventure, which you've probably been hearing about if you know anything about this game, because that's actually one of the best parts of the entire game. How the game starts out is that you are a space ranger, and you are trying to stop the full name, I believe, let's see, the full name is Space Rangers 2 Rise of the Dominators, and you're trying to stop the Dominators from taking over the galaxy, and you need to find them and destroy their home planet. Now, that's the main quest, and that's the main part of the game, but you don't have to do that if you don't want to. If you want to just fly your ship around and just find other people and kill them and raid them and take their loot and sell it, you can do that. If you wanted to go around and just sort of map out planets and find resources, you can do that. If you want to go around and build up a little armada of friends and go around defending, you know, innocent people from pirates, you can do that. If you want to take quests and, you know, deliver special papers or special shipments throughout the galaxy, you can do that. Whatever you want to do, you can do it. And there's, you know, it sort of tells you, okay, here's where the main quest is, and you can go do it, but it's up to you whenever you want to go around to do it. I will tell you, though, the game does get harder the longer you wait. The Dominators get stronger and stronger. So if you wait too long, you really will have to build up quite a fleet to actually take them on and defeat them. With that being said, how the game works is that you start off with a ship. The game is rebuilt. It's randomly generated galaxy every single time, so it's never quite the same game twice. There's five different races, and there's five different types of ships, and you can start off choosing whichever combination you want. The ship type really doesn't matter too much, in the sense that in the beginning you get a few extra things for your ship. For instance, if you're a pirate, you have some firepower and a little bit of storage capability for your ship, but if you're a cargo, if you're more into trading, merchant, you will have not as much firepower, but a much bigger cargo hold. If you're a fighter, you'll have a very strong ship and a very small cargo hold, etc. But you can buy new cargo holds and buy new ships throughout the game. What I recommend is that you get a cargo ship, and then you can easily get some more weapons on the ship, no problem, and get more powerful engines. When you start off the game, it gives you a quick tutorial. It shows you how you can mine asteroids for minerals. It shows you how you can actually hunt down and do combat. The combat in the game, pretty simple. In fact, there's actually almost nothing to it. All you do is, since it's turn-based, you can either say, whether or not you're attacking this turn and all the combat is done automatically. It's just determined whether or not you hit or not, depending upon range. All your weapons have different ranges, and then what direction you're flying in. It's sort of a top-down view. Or you can just say auto combat, which is what I mostly did, is you just hit auto combat, you sit back, and you just watch your ships go crazy and duke it out, and maybe pause it every couple of turns to make sure you're not dying too badly. The combat's not so deep, and that's sort of, you know, it's a little disappointing. It's not a massive amount to the combat, but it works. It's very fast-paced. It looks like a souped-up version of Asteroids, like in the year 2006. Like, if they designed it now, it's just totally nuts what's going on the screen. There's just so many things flying around. There's, like, comets and all these celestial bodies flying around, and things are smashing the planets all the time in the atmosphere. It's nuts. I mean, seriously, it's almost overwhelming how much is going on, but it's really interesting, a lot of fun. The actual real-time strategy combat, there's a whole other section of this game, is where you can actually go on the planets and build. It's no real resource management. What you actually have to do is build up robots, and you can build these robots however you want. You have some resources, you have to manage them, they're just given to you automatically, and you can build robots. You can put weapons on them, you can put long-range, short-range weapons, fast weapons, slow weapons. You can put on different types of legs on them for different types of traction, how fast they are, slow, etc. You just build up some robots, send them out, and hopefully you start taking over some bases. This is one section of the game I actually didn't really love, the real-time strategy combat, because it slows the game down. The whole game feels really fast-paced and like breakneck most times, but then the real-time strategy combat takes a while. It could take half an hour, an hour to finish up one combat, and you can skip it. That's one of the nice advantages, is that you can say very early in the game that you never want to have those type of missions, and you won't be offered them, and you don't have to do them. And finally, one of the coolest parts about this game, and it sounds insane, but these text-based adventures, is that you, for instance, were hunting down, like one time I was hunting down pirates, and I accidentally I was about to die, so you know what I said? I'm like, you know what? I give up. And you think, okay, that's it. You're going to give up. But you know what happened is that, and then like maybe time will go by. No, what happens is that you actually give up, and then you're transferred to a penal colony, and then you have to go through a little adventure of what you do. And you have to live your life for a period of 1 year, or it's like, you know, 200, 300 turns, and you have to decide how you're going to live your life. Whether you're going to, like, you know, go to the gym, whether you're going to bulk up, whether you're going to participate in these cockroach races, whether you're going to like deal in illegal sales, and it's up to you. And if you're not careful, you can die. Actually, you can very easily die if you're not careful inside the jail cell. So, but if you're good, you can make some new contacts, you get some new quests, you can get really bulked up, you can get stronger. It's crazy. It's like, it's something I've never seen, this weird mix of games. There was something else which I didn't get into because various reasons I didn't get into it enough, but there is another section where you can actually then become a planetary governor, and you actually have to go through and decide how to run the planet, and it's through these little text-based adventures. Again, it sounds weird, and it sounds like, what the heck's going on? There is a lot of text in this game, but these games often have a lot of text, like Star Control 2, just because there's so much going on in the game, and It doesn't slow it down at all, and quite frankly, it's so interesting and so well written that you will really get into it. That is one funny thing about this game, is that the game was designed and written in Russian, obviously, and then translated into English. And so sometimes you'll come across some really wacky stuff, but I'm reading an instruction book. They even cover that. They say, future speak, space rangers are set 1,000 years in the future, and you might find that when reading the in-game text, you come across terms of technology then the year 2005 you are unfamiliar with. This is understandable, that even in the year 3030 or 3300, there are people that do not fully appreciate why things happen. Additionally, find that the language used, although appears to be English, slightly odd. Don't worry, as in 2030, it was modified with non-English races to make it easy for the translation software to convert. So, you know what? Any game that goes through and explains to you why the English isn't quite perfect, and I have to say, it's like 99% perfect. It's very infrequently you get something wacky or weird, and considering how much text there is in this game, I'm amazed how well it's actually translated from Russian into English. It adds to the charm. It's a wonderful addition to the game. And that's pretty much the whole game. There's things, as I said, you go to equipment stores, you can update your, ships, you can add more phasers to them or add more firepower, you can go on different types of quests. Some of these quests are good quests where you're trying to help out people. Some are evil quests where you're trying to smuggle in goods. Obviously, if you do these bad quests, you can get a bad reputation, and then all the races start hunting you down. Before you know it, everyone's trying to kill you. There's a whole ranking system where you're officially licensed Space Ranger, and you can see how well you are up against the other Space Rangers. The better you are, the more famous you are, then you can recruit other people to help you out. You can have little followings, and you can build up little fleets. Again, it's very similar to Star Control 2. There's these black holes you find, and then even that requires a little text-based adventure. Once you find the black hole of how to go into hyperspace, you can go to these planets. You can explore these planets, send down probes that will take, over time, will actually gather information on the planet, and then you can find resources or maybe even special quests. This game, it's one of those games you just keep playing it, and there's just so many things happening. You don't know what the heck's going on half the time, and yet you cannot stop playing it because I've never seen anything quite like it. It's such a strange mix of cultures and quests and gameplay, and it almost hurts my head, but yet I can't stop playing it. As I said, this game comes out March 16th, 2006. I hear they actually improved the language and they redid the English translation here and there in different parts. And this game, wow, this game you really should take a look at. You've just never seen anything like it. By the way, the graphics, beautiful graphics. The worlds look amazing. One thing I did not like so much is the ability to actually, it was hard sometimes to find your ship. There's a lot of things going on. There are some quick keys that will make you find your ship very quickly. Something else is that a lot of things you'll see repeat after a while. It's good and bad. The good part is that because things repeat so often, like the mission, not the missions, but the type of missions sometimes, and the type of equipment and things you can buy on planets, you can very quickly jump on the planets and see what's for sale, and within a few seconds determine what's good and what's not and what good prices are. But at the same time, it does add a little bit monotony to the game in some aspects. It's equipment, it's the same equipment every single planet. It's hard to find, you know, sort of unique equipment. But you can then find these space stations that will upgrade your equipment, and you can even determine if you want to have like the novice, like the intern, to work on your engines to make it, make him see if he could like make it really good, or do you want to have like the ace mechanic work on your engines and see if he can get something out of it, or do you just want to have the local guy do it? And you know, they cost different amounts. Again, I can't even get into the game. So crazy, but great game, a lot of fun. People in Europe, if you can, go get this game. If you like this type of game, people in the U.S., if you really can't wait for it, you can go to like Go Gamer. I know they sell it. And one thing I will say about this game is it does have, it's really bad, but it does have, what's that, Star Control or Star Force? You know, that nasty, it's that really nasty software protection that is on this game, and they don't tell you that when you first get it. But I actually personally, I don't mind it so much. It doesn't affect my computer, but I know some people who actually won't even buy games that have the Star Force control on it, a software control, but I will mention it just because I don't want people to go out and buy this game and then find out it did have it on it and then decide that they're not going to play it. But I give this game 8.5 out of 10. Great game. It's a little rough around some edges because it really does break so many conventions. It actually takes a little bit even to get used to. But you're going to be having a fun time the whole time, and you're going to get sucked right into this game. Definitely, definitely try it.
Gaming Steve's Retro Review.
So my retro review is Pathways into Darkness for the Macintosh computer system. And this came out in 1993, and it is probably one of the absolute best first-person shooters of all time. And no one talks about it. Now, the main reason is because it came out for the Mac, I think is one of the main reasons. Not too many people played it. It's funny, I looked for it, and there's very little even on like game FAQs. Like, and Moby Games doesn't even list it. It's like not even listed anywhere. But it's Bungie's game. It's one of their best games. If you like Halo, it's funny. It's like a lot of people are like, oh, you know, Halo's so amazing. But I've been playing Bungie games since the beginning. You know, I played Minotaur, I played Pathways into Darkness, I played all three Marathon games, I played both Myth games. And you know what? those games blow Halo away. Like, you think Halo's good? You should play these games. Pathways to Darkness, very dated. Plus, it only works in the Mac. There never was a PC version released. So it's probably pretty tricky to find this game and try to play it now. But I would be interested to see how it played, because this was a very, very hard game. Really, really hard game. What made it so hard is that the game itself was extremely difficult. Like, right in the beginning of the game, there was two entrances you could go down. If you went down the wrong entrance, you quickly found out that you were going to die, and you had to go back and start over again and go right down the right entrance. You could actually get to the end of the game and do a couple things wrong and die. There's instant death all over the place. You know, I don't know if anyone would do these sort of things nowadays. There was things that you had to find that were hidden. If you didn't find them, you couldn't finish the game. I mean, this was a really difficult game. Limited saves, of course, so you had to find these save ruins, so when you get to a new level, it's a first-person shooter game, and it was about 25 levels, so when you get to a level, you had to actually find the save ruin, so you can even save on that level. There was a time limit. You only had 6 days to actually bring a nuclear bomb down to the last level of the dungeon and set it off to destroy or put this god back to sleep, and if you didn't do it on time and then get out, you had to put down the bomb, then get out of the dungeon, and then get to a safe distance, then you died. And the puzzles in this game were nuts. So a lot of people call this a first-person shooter RPG. And not only was it one of the very, very first-person shooters ever created, it is one of the best. There were things that were done in this game that were done later in Half-Life. And this was years ahead of Half-Life. And also the graphics of the time, full-color, beautiful graphics, you know, for the time, for 1993. Especially considering, you know, Macintosh computer really had the best graphics and sound capabilities back in 1993. You know, DOS was still being used, limited memory, limited graphics. You know, it was really VGA, it was nasty type graphics. Here you had full 640 by 480, full color, you know, thousands and thousands of colors. Ooh, beautiful graphics, 8-bit graphics, digitized sound effects, blah, blah, blah. And hey, I'll get back and let me get into the game and give you guys a real quick overview. One thing is that if you like the Bungie mythos, this game actually has a lot of the Bungie mythos in it, and a lot of it actually originated not just in Pathways in Darkness, but in Marathon as well. So you should definitely check those games out if you're really into Halo and want to know more about it. The game starts out as that you, as I said before, are special forces, and you have to detonate a nuclear bomb, but you got separated from your group when you parachuted in. There's this ancient pyramid in the middle of Mexico. You have no idea what you're doing there, what's going on. You go into the pyramid and you're all by yourself. All you have is a gun and you have a knife, and that's it. It also turns out that you find out throughout the game is that there's these Nazis that appeared in the 1930s that found this temple and were trying to get some ancient artifacts to use in the war. And what makes this game so amazing is that you find out how this game worked and the history of the game through the dead people. Right away in the very beginning of the game, you find this yellow crystal, and you actually then have these things called conversations with the dead. The yellow crystal will allow you to talk to the dead. You talk to the dead, and they're like moaning. Some guys just moan and go on about how cold it is and how miserable they are in death. Other guys you could ask questions to. You could actually interview them. And it's not choose your own adventure. You actually have to have an interface. All it says is an interface box, so you actually have to type in. I mean, it's how hard this game is. You actually have to type in what you wanted to ask them. And it was hard just to figure out what you wanted to even ask these guys. But through talking to them, you'd find out what was in the pyramid, you'd find out what type of monsters you would encounter, how you would kill them. A lot of these monsters did not use normal means. Some of the monsters, for instance, very early in the game, you get attacked by these spirits. Of course, nothing works on them. You don't have guns. Guns doesn't work on these spirits. So you have to get this crystal, crystal that will freeze them. Then after you freeze them, then you can shoot them and blow them up. Some creatures are invisible, so you have to walk around and shoot them using, you know, you have to get these infrared goggles all the time, but then when you're wearing the infrared goggles, then you can't see the other creatures, so you always have to switch back and forth. Did I mention this game was really tricky? Some things that are hidden in this game. There's one section is where you are actually getting killed. You are actually getting killed because you're getting hit so much. And you think, okay, and you can just sit there fighting forever trying to figure out how on earth you're supposed to get by this section. But the secret is that you have to find poison drink the poison where you start actually dying. But then as the creatures attack you, they actually take damage and they kill themselves because the poison kills them instantly. So one of the things you have to do is drink this poison, use that to kill them. And then while you're poisoned, you have to quickly find the antidote and then before you die. Did I say this game was hard? Other aspects is that the creature variation is very tough. Some of these creatures couldn't even be killed. That's how hard they are. Normal weapons couldn't kill them. You had all these different types of crazy weapons. You had, of course, Lugers. You had grenades. You had machine guns. But you had a limited amount of ammunition. As you got hurt, you had to rest. But, of course, if you rested too much, you ran out of time. And if you ran out of time, then the god woke up and destroyed the earth and ate the earth. Eventually, you get to the very end of the game. You have to fight 12 waves of all the monsters, and which is a brutal fight. Then you have to kill this demon. Then you have to correctly arm the nuclear device, which, by the way, the code changed on you, which you can only find out if you speak to the right guys on your dead squad, speaking to the dead. And then you have to find the detonator so you can get out of there. And then after all that's said and done, and you finally get out of this crazy, crazy dungeon. By the way, you have to go back out. That's the other thing. You don't just go out. You actually have to then go back through the dungeon. There was one of six endings, and I'll even read you some of these endings. Like, here's one. It's like, after you finally get out, he says, "You've escaped the pyramid. Unfortunately, you forgot to arm the nuclear device, and the world will soon be destroyed, despite all your heroics under the pyramid." Oh, here's another one. "You've escaped the pyramid. Unfortunately, you set the bomb to detonate after the god was already awakened. Oops, the world will soon be destroyed." Or here's the best one. "You've escaped the pyramid. Unfortunately, you don't have a radio beacon, and the bomb goes off before you're able to reach a safe distance on foot. You have died, but look on the bright side. At least you saved the planet." So there's lots of other. Oh, here's another one. "You've escaped the pyramid. Unfortunately, the bomb goes off before the extraction team is able to retrieve and carry you to safety. You have died. At least everyone else in the world won't suffer the same horrible fate." And then finally, the only one that you really do, there's two where you win. One's okay, but "You've escaped the pyramid. The extraction team picks you up and carries you to safety. Right on schedule, the bomb detonates and buries the dreaming god. You have won. Hurrah. Yay." So that's like the perfect way you can actually win this game. But this game, crazy. There's actually some of these flying rat monsters. There's like all these flying crazy creatures. Oh, it's a nutty, nutty, nutty game. I would really love to try to play this game today. I do remember how tough this game was, and I would be interested to see if it was just tough for the time or it was just limited in the movement. But also, since I did play it once, it is probably a little bit easier to play now. But this is a great game, totally unsung. No one talks about this game, but if you've had it, you know what I'm talking about. I'd be surprised. I'd like to hear from anyone who actually finished this game, because a lot of people, it's one of those games that's just so hard. There are very few people I know. Even I, the only reason I finished it is because I was really bored one summer, and I just said to myself, I was determined to finish this game, come hell or high water. And really nice level design. You start off in this pyramid, you go up this pyramid, you find this key, then you go all the way back down the pyramid, then there's these catacombs under there, and you have to go through these catacombs, and then you eventually start teleporting around, that you end up, and it tells you your elevation, you end up 2 miles below the surface of the earth where the sleeping god is, and then you finally destroy him. So you really feel like you've gone on a crazy adventure by the time you're done with this game. But Pathways in the Darkness by Bungie, one of the best games they ever did. And you know what? I will do in the future Marathon and Myth, because, oh, those are such good games. I really wish Microsoft would let them develop something other than Halo. But anyhow, there we go. I love this game. I give it a 9.5 out of 10, and that is my retro review for this week.
Name that game!
So Name That Game is my weekly contest where I will play a clip to a game and you have to tell me the name of the game and what platform it's on, whether it's like PC or Mac or arcade or whatever. And I will play the clip and you tell me the name. And I give you a prize. You write back to me, tell me your address. So let's listen to last week's clip. So that wasn't so bad, and that was, of course, GoldenEye 007 for the Nintendo 64. And as you can imagine, a lot of people got this one right. A lot of people said way too easy, but yeah, you know what? It wasn't so bad. Anyhow, let's take a look at what I got here. And I had about, a couple hundred people who got this one right. And the winner is, let's see, he writes, that clip is GoldenEye 07 for the N64, starting from the Mission Select difficulty setting and then beginning the streets level. Thanks. Joshua Keisner from North Little Rock, Arkansas. So, Joshua, you have won. So send me your address. And right now I still have, I have some T-shirts, but I only have large and medium T-shirts, if that's, is that what you want. I also have these really cool Mario dioramas from Super Mario Brothers, and it shows you, you can sort of set them up however you want. They're really nice. And I also have these stamps, for these video game stamps from France. So tell me what you want, and I'll send it your way, and send me your address. And that being said, let's listen to this week's clip.
Astro Bovis, Virata, Mastodon, Kalpa.
So once again, that's the clip for this week. If you think you know it, send your answer to game@gamingsteve.com. It's just game@gamingsteve.com. Just send me the name of the game and the platform it's from. And if you are correct, next week I will pick your name and you're picked. Send me your address and you win a prize. And with that, let's get to show mail. Okay, so for show mail this week, since I'm really going over on time, I'm not going to answer any of the written questions just because there's just too many. I'm sorry, guys. I will hold them for hopefully next time, but this show's getting really long. So let's listen to the first question.
Hey, Steve. This is David. I know you've said in the past that adventure game elements have kind of been worked into other genres of gaming, and I think that's true to some degree, but what I used to really love about adventure games was not just puzzle solving, but it was the story aspect of it. I think you get a game like Myst 3 or Myst 4 especially, it is just incredible how immersive a game like that can be. You really care about the characters, you want to see where the plot is going to go, you want to solve this mystery. Other games to a lesser extent, like Siberia and others, you just really get hooked into a story. And I haven't seen that really in any other genre. Even a game like World of Warcraft, they've written tons of backstory for the game. Almost every character you meet has got some huge story. It's like a Lord of the Rings epic, really. But it doesn't make any difference in the game. You can play the game and kill these characters, and it's not going to advance the plot, because it's an MMO. You know, that same character will be back 7 days later, and you can go kill him again if you want. So, you just don't get the same kind of unfolding storyline that you would in an adventure game. So, I guess here's my question. Do you think that adventure games are on a cyclical downturn right now, that they're out of favor, but maybe in, you know, a few years, maybe a decade, people are going to start wanting those LucasArts style, those Cyan style games again? Or do you think that the environment in gaming has just totally changed and the kind of people who played adventure games in the 80s and 90s just don't exist anymore, never will? And if that's so, what role do you think storytelling is going to have in gaming in the future? Where's a gamer going to be able to go if he really wants to get totally immersed in a complex, a long story, a well-written story, where he can get interested in the lives of the characters, where he can see that story unfold from beginning to end? Because that's the kind of game that I'd really like to play again. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Hey, Dave. Wow, that's a real long question. So, guys, in the future, 30 seconds, okay? 30 seconds, a minute if you have to, but no longer. Otherwise, I might not air your questions. So, adventure. Do I think adventure games are out of style right now? Will they come back, and what type of games? All right. So, yeah, I love adventure games, too, but you have to keep in mind, you know, adventure games, one of the reasons adventure games came about is that they really worked well on older computers. And, in essence, adventure games were sort of books. And if you, all technologies, I actually studied this, it was actually history technology back in college, is that all new technologies sort of are based on previous technologies, because they're not exactly ever sure how to use them. For instance, Perfect example is when television first came about, they used to do radio dramas on TV because they didn't even know what to do. You know, like they didn't really understand the medium. So they just sort of took their old medium and adapted it to the new one. And this always sort of happens. And this is a perfect example is that the first games, and these were the most popular games back in the early 80s for the game systems, were adventure games. It's because, you know what? Graphics weren't that great. The audio didn't exist. There wasn't even audio for these game systems, really. But the ability to display lots of text was very simple and very easy. You know, Infocom made a fortune doing nothing but writing very complex adventure games that had no graphics whatsoever. It was all text-based with zero sound, and they made a huge amount of money doing that. And other types of games, like Wizard and the Princess and the King Quest series, had very rudimentary, very basic graphics, but it was mostly story. And that was a big part of it, is that it was allowed you to tell a slower type of game. And these were basically nothing more than really advanced choose-your-own-adventures, if you think about it. And that was a big part of why these games were so popular. Over the last couple of years, as the hardware and the software has gotten much, much more powerful, those type of games, they're a little too slow-paced, and they are sort of going out of style because, you know what? The issues that were around in the early 80s are no longer around. You know, the sounds are fantastic. Audio is fantastic. The graphics are amazing. And so the stories sort of get, you know, very deep storylines almost get shafted because, you know what, it's not something you can see. And it's also something, you know, it's like, ooh, look at the graphics on that game. Oh, I don't really care if it has a really deep storyline, but it looks amazing. And that's what all that matters. And it sounds great. Well, what about this game? Well, it doesn't look so good. You know, some of the games you even mentioned, those are very good games and they look quite beautiful, but they're slow paced and they have pre-rendered screens and they just don't have the same life that like a Halo might have to it, or even a Madden Football has to it, or Resident Evil 4. But that's where we're going nowadays, is really with these sort of hybrids. You know, perfect example is Jade Empire. If you want to have a good game that has a really deep story, I would say pick up Jade Empire, or even better yet, Knights of the Old Republic. Okay, that probably is the best adventure game I've played ever. And it takes place in Star Wars. You know, that's a great game. Indigo Prophecy, that's a new type of, you know, a lot of people are actually saying that might be the new type of adventure game, is that it's a very fast-paced game with a very deep story. Unfortunately, it kind of falls apart at the end, but other than that, it is a really good game. Believe it or not, I would also even go far as to say that Resident Evil 4 is in some way sort of an adventure game. It's not the same style as, obviously, like the Myst-type games, but because it has such a deep story and it has all these different points where you have to quickly decide on what you're going to do, it's not really a first-person shooter. It's sort of some weird mix of a hybrid. So, or even the game I reviewed today, or actually two of them. I'd say Oblivion is also kind of like that, adventure game, and I'd say Space Rangers 2 is sort of like this type of game. But the old style game that you like and that I like too, they're not dead and gone, but those will probably be around for other technologies that have limited capabilities, i.e. maybe cell phones, maybe the web, things like that. That's really where you're going to find those type of games. But unfortunately, they're kind of gone forever. I really wish it wasn't true, but it is. And you're just going to have to sort of do these hybrid RPG / adventure games. Or you can pick up the old ones. Hey, you heard in the story, in the new stories, that Vivendi's re-releasing all the old Sierra Online games. You can just play them. No problem with that. I'm replaying Baldur's Gate 2 right now. Okay, this game's 5 years old, and I have to tell you, I just a little shock to my system seeing the graphics, because they really are, they're almost kind of funny, and I can't even believe this is a BioWare game. Story's so damn good, who the heck cares? So thanks for your question. Let's listen to the next one.
Hi, Steve. This is Gilbert from Sweden, a.k.a. Excellence, and I just wanted to ask you a question about dual screen supporting games. I know in the beginning when they started supporting dual screens on the graphic cards, there were a lot of talk about games that, for instance, would have a map on one screen and the battlefield on the other and so forth, but that never happened. So, do you know of any game except for X2 that have had or will have support for dual screens? Keep up the good show. Thanks.
Hey, Gilbert. So, from Sweden, dual screen support for PC games, not a lot that I can think of. Let's see, Microsoft Flight Simulator, of course, I've seen, actually, there's this picture, I forgot where it is, there's this guy who actually put up, I think, 16 monitors to use as his flight cockpit. It's really amazing to see, you know, you can use more than one screen. I believe Star Trek Armada 2 also could use two screens. I also believe Star Wars Galaxies and Sirius Sam, The Second Encounter, and Subcommand. That's all I can think of. I believe all of those have the ability to use two screens. But I know what you're talking about. Like, for a real-time strategy game, if you could have the map, say, on one screen, and then on the other screen have the combat, or something similar, even with, say, like, a first-person shooter, where you maybe could have the map in your inventory on one side of the screen, and then on the second screen you could actually have the action. But, yeah, no, they're not doing it yet. But, you know, as more and more people buy more monitors, and as more people ask. A perfect example of this sort of occurring is with widescreen support. You know, more and more games now get widescreen support because people are starting to buy widescreen monitors. But the big issue with having these dual screens is it's also a hardware issue. It's just how much hardware that, you know, what they can use to run these things. And to have two screens going, you know, that's a lot, okay? That's a lot going on the processor. And yeah, maybe one has 3D rendering and the other one just has the map, but still, it's pretty difficult to program. You know, really, the things you'd probably see more often is something like a Microsoft Flight Simulator, where you can put two or three screens or 10 screens next to each other, and you just see a lot more of the action, as opposed to something where you're actually using two screens and one screen has the action on another, one that just has maps and other information on it. But if there's other people out there who know of some dual screen games, those are all that I can think of off the top of my head. But, you know, I will say, don't expect this to be implemented too often. It also is an unfair advantage, keep in mind, especially if you're doing competitive gaming, you know, like Battlefield 2 or something. It's a big unfair advantage if you have two screens and can do that as opposed to someone else who has one. And they like to keep everything on the same playing field. So, thanks for the question. Next, I have Val.
Hi, Steve. This is Val from Denver. I'm curious, what are your thoughts about all these rumors recently that Microsoft is coming out with a portable gaming platform? I know that all their focus is on the 360 right now, and it seems that sooner or later they'll have to respond somehow to compete with the PSP and the DS and maybe even the iPod. And then secondly, a few months ago, Beggar Prince was announced for the Genesis. I thought that was pretty neat. I'm curious, do you see more of this type of thing going on at all, maybe with other consoles, or maybe with games that were far along in the development cycle and then were canceled for whatever reason? I mean, can we expect to see more of that, or is that just a one-off thing and we'll never see that again? And then lastly, to go really retro, pinball machines. Pinball games. Whatever happened to those things? I'm curious, did you ever play them? And if so, what were your favorites? Thanks. Great show.
Hey, Val. So, three questions you had in there. Rumor control, new Microsoft portable gaming device. You know what? I don't know about that. I mean, I guarantee someone's doing something in Microsoft that's sitting there figuring this stuff out. But Microsoft's probably more interested in, instead of coming out with their own device, is to come out with the operating system for other people's devices, or to partner with someone and come out with, you know, that's what they really care about. I mean, perfect example is the cell phones. You know how they're coming out with these cell phones with these portable versions of Microsoft in them, Windows. That really is more interesting to Microsoft, because they don't have to worry about hardware. Software is cheap. You know, they're one of the richest companies in the world for very good reasons, because they sell information. If you think about it, it's like Windows and Office and Windows XP. That is just, you know, it's just some software information on a floppy, or not even a floppy, on a disk, and that's it. They don't have to worry about selling computers. They don't have to worry about massive inventory and manufacturing costs. I mean, that's why they're losing such a mint on the Xbox 360. So I don't really think they're going to do their own portable gaming device. They're probably going to try to come up with portable gaming devices, middleware or software, or work with someone else. Maybe someone else would do the hardware and they can do all the software, and that's where they would make their money. Its next question is, will we ever see another Beggar Prince type release? Which, by the way, I was the one who mentioned all that and got a ton of press. But yeah, I don't really know. And it's funny because in Japan, these type of things where games are released on sort of dead systems, this is actually fairly common. Like games are released on Dreamcast still to this day. But this Beggar Prince is sort of a weird. I haven't spoken to these guys. Keep in mind, they're actually taking an old game and translating it into English that already was released. So they're not coming up with a new game, and then they're releasing it. So I think this is sort of a one-off thing. If you see this again, I'll be really surprised. I mean, I don't think they're going to, you know, it's one of those things, it sounds really cool, but are you going to go out and buy a game for your Sega Genesis? Really? I think it's very cool, but I'm probably not going to buy it myself, and I doubt a lot of people are out there going to either. And if you're going to, you know, develop for an older system, I'd say develop for the Game Boy Color and or something like that that has, 100 million units worldwide, as opposed to Sega Genesis, which is like a 16-year-old system. I don't know if you even have it in your house, as opposed to Game Boy, it still works fine with your DS. So that's the way I would go if you're going to develop for an old system. And then pinball games. Did I like pinball? Let me tell you something. I love pinball. In fact, I probably like pinball even more than video games. I love, 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 love pinball machines. Some of my absolute favorites, Attack from Mars. Oh, God, I love that game from Bally from like 1995-96. And also the sequel Revenge from Mars. Of course, the best-selling pinball game of all time, over 20,000 years old, The Addams Family from 1992 in Bally. That is, oh my God, is that a good pinball machine? It's still to this day, because there was just so many. There was like these little quests you can go on inside the pinball machine. It also was the first that had digital sound effects that were taken from the movie, and it was always nice and loud. And I still remember the multi-ball, 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 and it was like thank you thing. If there's ever a pinball machine that I would buy, that would be it. But I also liked things like Funhouse and Whirlwind and Earthshaker and just all those type of machines. I actually like to go. There's these things called Nathan's. You probably heard Nathan's Franks, but Nathan's in New York, they actually have arcades as well. And there's this one near Roosevelt Field that I go to, and they have a really big arcade, and they have tons of pinball machines. I like to go there and just play pinball. And it's great because it uses real skill as opposed to – now, the video games don't use real skill, but there's, like, real skill in the pinball. It's a tactile feel to it. It's a little bit of luck. You know, it's great. I can just spend – all day in a pinball parlor. But thanks for your question. Oh, now you're making me want to go and play pinball. And let's get to my last question from Brian.
Hi, Steve. My name is Brian, and I'm from California, and I have a question for you about Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion. Do you think that Bethesda was right in delaying the title from the launch? And did you notice any major changes from when you played it in October at that event? Thanks. I love the show. Keep up the great work. Bye.
Hey, Brian. So Oblivion, huh? So were they right in delaying the title, and were there any changes? I said I didn't see any changes from November, and as for them being right for delaying the title, yeah, you know what? They were, and I'll tell you why. It's because they say they need to delay the title, then they need to delay the title. And you know what? There's an old saying that we used to say when we were developing software is that if you release something that's not done all the way or is buggy or has problems, people will never forget it. But if you release something that's late and it's perfect, no one will remember that happened. And that's the same thing. It's like when Oblivion is finally released, would you rather have had Oblivion released 6 months ago? And yeah, you could be playing it now or whatever it was about 4 months ago. But maybe had some issues or there was a little bit of bugs or some balance problems and this was not quite the game you wanted it to be. Would that really be better than having to wait a few months and having the game come out now where it's actually better, it's actually more balanced, and it's more finished and more polished? Will you even remember in a year from now that it was late? No, you won't. Maybe you will, but you're not going to remember, oh my God, I was in so much pain that the game was late. Now, you forget that, okay? People forgive things that are late. A good example, Titanic. Look at Titanic, the movie I'm talking about. That movie, if you remember when that thing first came out in 1996, the people were going, oh my God, this movie's been delayed. This movie is over budget. It's the most expensive movie in history. They had two studios that were going to come out and put this movie, oh God, this thing is going to ruin everyone. What happens? Comes out, becomes, the number one movie of all time in history, makes almost $2 billion worldwide. You ever hear anyone complain about that anymore? Mm-mm. You don't. So, same thing. I wouldn't worry too much. I think Oblivion's going to be just fine. And if that's what it needs, then that's what it needs. Delay it. And from what I know, it's coming out pretty soon. So, I wouldn't worry too much longer. It's just a few more weeks / months to go. And sorry, I do have more questions. A lot of guys who wrote me. But if you have a question, I just can't get to it. It's just too much going on. Send me your question. Send me your MP3. Put your name in it. Try to keep it within 30 seconds to a minute at most. Try not to make it too much longer. You can send it to feedback at gamingsteve.com. You can send it to Game at GamingSteve. Both those will get to me, no problem. And just if you tell me also in the text that you're sending me an audio question, it'll be helpful. So with that, let's get to final thoughts.
Final thoughts.
Hey, so that is a crazy, crazy show. There was a lot going on in that show, and I'm tired actually from doing this one. But I talked a bit about Oblivion. As I said, this game, man, it is like under my skin. I actually feel this weird itch, like I gotta play this game, and I can't wait to like put it into my computer and try it up again. Oh, it's annoying, but. Wow, it's so good. It really was impressed. Again, I only played it 6 hours, so it's hard to know what this game will be like after playing it. But, the funny thing is I didn't really even like... I've actually played them all, and I never really liked the original games because they were just too open-ended, and there was just wildly unbalanced creatures all over the place. But I really, playing this game, felt that throughout, it was really well-balanced. It was never too hard. I did die a few times, which was actually a good thing because you don't want the game to be too easy either. And it was just paced, just right, just really well done. Graphics beautiful, sound effects fantastic, voiceovers great. This really might be one of the greatest role-playing games I've ever seen, / adventure games. And people who like The Sims might actually really like this game because of the open-endedness. I know a lot of people listen to the show also really big into The Sims and Maxis-type games. And this is, and also, I've said this before and I'll say it again, it's almost like Grand Theft Auto. And might people think, what? What the heck am I talking about? No, stick with me. It actually is in a lot of ways because Grand Theft Auto, one of the brilliant things about the Grand Theft Auto game, the last couple, is that you have this whole living, breathing world and allows you to do anything you want. If you want to go on the main quest, go right ahead. If you want to spend time, rescuing people with the ambulance, you can do that. If you want to be a vigilante, whatever you want. You want to deliver pizzas? This game has the exact same feel to it. If you want to go on the main quest, go right ahead. However, if you want to go to the Thief Guild and become a thief, you can do that. If you want to go to the Mage's Guild and go on a couple of those quests, you can do it as well. If you don't want to do any quests and just sort of go explore and find the 200 dungeons in the world and explore those and just build up your characters, do that. If you want to become an outlaw and steal everything you can in sight, you can do that. Whatever you want. And it's just like Grand Theft Auto in that sense. And that's the best sense. It's just the open-ended aspect of play and the feeling like you're in this living, breathing world that is responding to you. It's almost like a single-player, massively multiplayer game. Without the massively multiplayer, except take out the massively multiplayer, and then the online. In fact, it's just take like WoW. Imagine if it was WoW, but every single creature in the game was computer-controlled with very good AI, and you were in the game. That's kind of what this is like, except with much better graphics. But look for next week, and I'll do my second part of the Oblivion preview and try to wrap it all up. But for now, and also next week, I believe, is the first year anniversary of the show. And if anyone has any ideas of anything fun or special I can do on the show, let me know. But with that being said, this is Gaming Steve signing off. Hope you guys have a good gaming week, and I will talk to you and see you next week. Bye.
Question or comment for Steve, please drop him a line at GamingSteve.com.
You've been listening to Gaming Steve. Until next week, keep exploding those barrels.